Hey guys, Adam Ray here for the About Last Night podcast. We are back Monday. Hope you had a great weekend. Hope you're having a great start to the week. Back in the saddle Monday, starting it off right with a banger of an episode today. So look, I used to do a podcast with Chuck Liddell called Icebreakers. We did about 10 episodes. The episodes were fun. Chuck's a great dude. He's a big teddy bear of a human, a sweetheart. And it was a lot of fun getting to know him, becoming chums with him, and having some fun with some people that we got to talk to because of Chuck. So one of those people we got to talk to was Matthew McConaughey. And the episode got released, was great, was one of the most fun conversations I've ever had. Obviously, the guy's a legend in the world of acting. And it was a real treat. And it's about an hour and a half. And I thought to myself, this episode on YouTube only has a couple thousand views. Why the fuck would I not put it out to the alien listeners, to the Adam Rabies, and let them enjoy a McConaughey interview that I honestly feel like, and I've listened to a lot of them, is one of the best ones he's done. Chuck and I asked great questions, and we just had a blast, dude. It was a lot of laughs, a lot of really thoughtful, articulate, fun conversation bits and tidbits, and so I wanted to put it out for you guys. So that's what today's episode is. Me, Chuck Liddell, Matthew McConaughey. So make sure to subscribe and rate the podcast on iTunes. Download it, share it, pass it on to your friends, your lovers, your enemies, your parents. Of course, subscribe on YouTube where you can also watch this episode. And AdamRayComedy.com for all my tour dates this weekend. I will be in Seattle. I'm coming back home, baby. Laughs Comedy Club. 4 shows, August 12th and 13th. So come out and see me at Laughs Comedy Club. Can't wait. The show's going to be packed. Bring in Sandy Danto. Some surprises on the way. And then next weekend, I am in L.A. And then I'm in Escondido, California at the Grand Comedy Club. And then I'm back in Tempe, Arizona at the Tempe Improv, September 1st through the 4th. All these tickets and tour dates through November at AdamRayComedy.com. Young Rock comes back on NBC in November. You can watch Gaslit and Pam and Tommy out now. The Hulu Chippendale show that I did, which is going to premiere in October. Thank you for all the love on that Deadline article that got posted. That was a fucking real treat. And I can't wait. More good stuff on the way. Now that we got the tour dates, Twitter handles, and merch info out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with me, Chuck Liddell, and Matthew McConaughey.
Hey, it's Herbert. And you're listening to the About Last Night podcast, you slippery little son of a bitch.
First of all, my name is Adam Ray. Nice to meet you, Matt.
Hey, Adam.
Yeah.
Hey, Chuck.
What's up? How you doing?
Have you guys officially met before? I know you probably know this guy, but is this
No, we don't know each other. But I know what he does.
I know of him. Yeah. Yeah, what is your first, can we swap, first memories of Chuck Liddell in the McConaughey world? When did he get on your radar?
I don't know specifically what it would have been, just that he was just one of the original badasses, man.
There it is.
A feared man in the cage early on. I mean, man. So when did you start?
My first UFC was UFC 17 back in 98. I started kickboxing in 92. Did that until then, and then started fighting in the UFC.
Yeah,
and I'm a white belt in Taekwondo.
It took off in 2005. I was the first coach of the Ultimate Fighter.
Right.
And when the Ultimate Fighter launched, I mean, it seemed like we went from being obscure and not, I could tell you who knew who I was by looking at their shirt, what they were wearing, to me not being able to tell who knows who I was. I mean, it just blew up from there.
Yeah, hadn't it? It's blown completely up, man. Yeah. I mean,
it's gone crazy.
I don't know. Did you ever think it would become as big as it has?
I always thought it would, but I just thought it would I thought it would take a lot longer. I think the, you know, that getting in on the reality show thing that we kind of got our, Dana calls it his Trojan horse, to get a live fight on TV, free TV, and having that be that Forrest and Bonner fight where it was just such a great fight to have as the main fight, the first fight on live TV, that, you know, it just exploded way faster than anyone thought it would.
That's the one where they both just beat the snot out of each other the whole time.
Oh, yeah, right? The whole time, back and forth. It was, you got to see all the elements of MMA in it. There were takedowns, they were getting up there.
Yeah.
And there's everything going on, and it was just an amazing fight, you know. So that helped it explode. And then I won the title the week later, knocking Randy out. So I was, it was a great week for me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you pretty, intense fan when you're watching? Are you screaming at the TV, throwing shit, or are you just kind of kicking back, having a cocktail, enjoying the art?
A little of both.
Yeah.
A little of both. I mean,
everything in moderation.
You know, no, I mean, it matters. A good fight gets me off my feet.
Yeah.
Any good competition gets me off my feet.
For sure.
And then, you know, my kids watch it with us. You know, we got some people argue with me about, oh, why would you let your kids watch that? I'm like, look, I mean, it's two people coming in a closed space with what God gave them.
Yes.
Not a weapon. You ain't got a knife. You got a gun. There are rules. And I'll talk with the kids about it. No matter what happened at the end, they both went over and shook or checked on each other. I mean, it's a great form of competition. And it's one of the examples in sports, not that life should be a fight like that, but man, people could learn a lot from sports and even UFC. I mean, that you go and you go at it. The rules are clear coming in. Both of you know what it is. You got what God gave you. It's best your body and mind and spirit can do in a certain amount of time. And then when it's over,
I'm actually friends today with a lot of the guys that I fought, both guys I beat and guys I lost to. So I mean, we respect the sport, and it's a sport to us. You know, we out there and we're just competing. I was trying to hurt you when it started, but when it's over, I hope you're all right.
Heard. Yeah. And I hear you, man. I think,
I hear that a lot lately, actually, too. I hear that a lot lately from people like, hey, some of my best memories with my dad were watching you fight. So, I mean, it's kind of cool.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, Matthew, with all the celebrity boxing and fighting popping off, does it make you start to go, you know what, man? Me and Will Smith never finished that fight about whether it's pronounced Fanta or Fonta. Time to settle it in the octagon, baby.
Right? I mean, yeah, look at what it's funny what's happening.
Yeah.
Now, do you hear those? Somebody was talking about a storyline. It was that last, I think it was the last Jake Paul fight, but it was one of the pre-fights. And they're like, this guy's from England and he's rich and he's a billionaire and he's fighting this other guy. And you heard him put the storyline up because evidently they had a beef at the Grammys about 4 years ago where so-and-so's with this girl and he wouldn't introduce him and he got dissed and they're going to have it. That's how I was like, and it made me want to watch more. And I was going back. I was like, oh, man, they could have these. They're gonna have. They can put together these fights for the rest of time. You can make it's a soap opera. You can make it up. You can make up a storyline about why two people got to beef with each other.
Oh yeah,
even if it ain't true.
Milking the drama. This guy walked in and took the urinal that was too small for him, so he had to use the stall, the handicap stall of all stalls. Yeah, it's just.
And he made him use the one with no toilet paper.
Yeah. We'll see who's wiping who Sunday night. Yeah.
And you know what? That little storyline gets millions of viewers.
I'm fired up right now. Yeah. I know. First of all, dude, thank you so much for making time. I know you, you're busy as, I don't know if there's a better word to describe that in your life right now. But first of all.
Thankfully, I am busy right now. I'm happy to be busy. Yeah.
Do you, is being busy the way you operate? I know some people, I can speak for myself, like I don't operate to the best of my potential if I don't have too much going on to try to manage.
Yeah, look, I mean, I got three kids now.
Yeah.
And I mean, that if you're a father, you know, you're busy even if you ain't got work, you know what I mean?
For sure.
So, but at the same time, I'm a guy who's, I'm kind of addicted to accomplishment. I'm addicted, you know, I get self-significance by finishing stuff up, by having something I'm building to work on, to try and finish or evolve. And I'm good on a vacation for about a week.
That's pretty long.
And then after about a week, I'm like, oh, man, I need something to do.
Yeah.
I can do it here on the beach. Okay. I don't mind, but I need something to do. I gotta be constructive. You know what I mean? On doing something. Heck, if anything right now, I'm trying to work on being able to be relaxed on a vacation longer than a week and go, you ain't got to do nothing. You ain't got to set up something new. You don't have, you know, but I like being busy. I like having something to do. I like making a list the night before the shit I got to do tomorrow. And I love getting up the next day and knocking it out and crossing stuff off a list and going, it makes the drink taste better. It's 7 o'clock. It makes the food taste better.
Yeah.
It makes hanging out with the family feel better at the end of the night. I feel like I've earned it.
Well, one of my favorite lines in Green Lights, which by the way, phenomenal. Chuck and I both got through it and enjoyed the fuck out of it. I don't see how, by the way, you know, reading it obviously is an option, but I don't know, man. For people, if people are reading it, they're probably still doing your voice in their head, right? So why not just listen to the real thing, baby?
Yeah, that was actually my first audiobook. I've never actually done an audiobook before, but that was awesome. The read was awesome. Hearing it coming from your voice and a lot of things you said, like I believe a lot of things, those lessons, and I've always had a hard time explaining them to people.
Right.
You know, like, you know, yeah, the thing about boundaries. You know, for me, like I, as an athlete, and you get it with a lot of athletes, like I got to the top of my sport and I got to the end of it. And when it was over and I took away, I kind of let all those boundaries go away. I was lost. I mean, I was sitting there like, okay, now what? I had a lot of opportunities. I'm very lucky, man. Very blessed. A lot of opportunities, but I didn't know, have anything really controlling me to make, and I could let myself go a little crazy for a little while where I was like,
no structure.
I had no structure. I didn't have that thing pulling me back into the gym, that thing pulling me back into control. And that becomes a hard time for me. I get that a lot. I talk about it. So people come up to me. I get a lot of athletes, a lot of guys that are really good at what they did, really, they were done and they have the same problem when they're done, you know, done with their sport or done with what they're doing.
You look at that. I mean, yeah, a lot of athletes seem to have that. Look, rock stars have it. What happens when, you know, astronauts have it? What the hell is this? Or you want me to get a buzz about this and I've been to outer space?
Yeah.
You want me to get a buzz in real life?
Yeah.
It's tough for that. A rock star, they ain't on the stage anymore. What are you supposed to do? Well, you know, with that, you got to talk to my buddy Lance Armstrong, man. When he got off the bike, he was like, he had his cancer foundation. He was dedicating time to that, but he was like, it's not the same. He goes, I've lived on pedals for 7 hours a day all of my life, and I don't have my pedals. He was, you know, and all of a sudden life's four-dimensional, and you're like, I can do this, I can do that, I can do this. And even if you're in a position where you can do whatever the hell you want, that ain't easy, man.
Uh-uh.
I remember when I got Time to Kill was the first like big movie that was a studio movie that turned out to be a big hit.
Yeah.
The Friday before Time to Kill opened, there was 100 scripts I would have done anything to do. But 99 of those scripts were, no, not you. You can't do that. Over that 1 2-day weekend, or Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, by Monday afternoon of those 100 scripts I wanted to do, all of a sudden it was 99 yeses. You can do it. And I was like, wait a minute. You want me to tell you which one I want to do? And 3 days ago, I would have done anything to do any of them, and I couldn't do them. And now you're telling me I can do all of them? Shit. What do you mean, man? So to find that, you know, figuring it out what you want to do when you can do whatever is also really tough. But you don't have a schedule, man. What happens? I know if I don't have a schedule, you know, I had to tell that story in the book about taking that 2 years off.
Yeah.
Whew. Good thing I had a newborn son to keep me sort of grounded. But man, I got a little wobbly.
This was after.
Yeah, I think I had the same thing. I think that was, I had a newborn son, then I had a daughter when I was kind of right afterwards. I had a son and a daughter after. So I was, you know, that helped me. I just focused on my kids. I spent a lot of time. And by the way, they're a year and a half apart. That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, I thought having a second one would be like twice the work. No, the second one was like made it exponential.
Double time, yeah.
I had to work because when one was sleeping, the other one was up. But, you know, so it was a lot of work.
That 2 year break you talk about is after you said you want to take a break from romantic comedies, correct?
Rom-coms, yeah.
Yeah. So you were crushing that world.
By the way, I have to say this right now. Everyone asks me, what's your favorite type of movie? And I would think it's funny when I answer rom-com. And
my favorite, before we logged on.
My favorite one was How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. You come played on. That awesome. I love that movie.
Talk about, you know what residuals are, right? Little mailbox money.
Oh, yeah, baby.
That movie is by far and away.
Holy shit.
My biggest mailbox money giver that I've ever done. Wow. That son of a bitch, the gift that keeps on giving, man.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days.
That movie is so good. If anyone hasn't seen it, you need to watch it. You kill me in that.
How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, How to Buy 17 Boats in 5 Minutes. Is that kind of what it translated to?
Not 17, but damn sure got me renting me those houses in Malibu.
Holy
where I could go shirtless
shit.
On the beach and surf all day.
Holy shit. Wait, real quick before we talk about that break. So, and I know you mentioned this in the book, but was it a, because it's a pretty difficult thing to walk away from something that you work so hard to get to a point to where you are having all these things coming to you with, what do you want to do, right? And there's no, the rejection and the no's are pretty much done with, more or less, yeah? So,
After A Time to Kill, it was a hell of a lot more yeses than no's.
Right.
And then, you know, coming up to that break when I was doing romantic comedies, I was the go-to rom-com dude.
Yeah.
I was the guy.
At the height, it's awesome, right? Were you enjoying that? At the height, it's awesome, yeah? Were you enjoying that time, or did it get to a point to where it was like, creatively, I just need to shake it up?
I was enjoying it, but like Chuckle said, I needed more resistance.
Yeah.
I felt like I could read the damn script and do it tomorrow morning.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, well, that's cool, but I want to read something. Then I go, oh, shit, I don't know what I'm going to do with this role.
Right.
I'm scared of this, and I can't wait to go find out what I'm going to do.
You desire that next challenge, right? You want that next challenge, right?
Yeah, I needed,
that's what, for fighters, like.
I was enjoying it. But look, rom-coms, those are they're flip-flop Saturday afternoon characters.
Yeah.
You know, the consequences aren't that bad. And I mean, you know, I mean, you can't get too happy and you can't get too mad. If you get too mad in it, you sink the ship.
Right.
No, don't, you know, you don't really act how you truly feel in
right.
real life in rom-coms. You kind of keep them light and dance amongst the clouds. And I just had my son. And you know, when you have your first child, a man feels as vital as ever, man. I mean, your joys, your ceiling, your joys raise, the depth of your anger and even sadness is much deeper. You're just more vital, man. You're just alive. And life, real life's more like a drama. I mean, you know what I mean?
Totally.
And so I was having that vitality in my life, but I was going to work going, hoody-hoody-hum, hoody-hoody-hum, which was right on for the job.
Sure.
But I said, boy, can I find some work that maybe challenges the vitality of the life I'm living? Well, that work I wanted was not being offered to Matthew McConaughey. So I just said, I'm taking a sabbatical, making a one-way ticket to limbo, and hopefully I'll get a job again, but I don't know.
I got to assume reps, family, everyone that is watching this train just full steam ahead, and you kind of, you know, taking a pit stop more or less, and right? People are probably freaking out. Like, how do you manage that? How do you manage like the, hey, right. It's my fucking career. You don't owe me. Like, I mean.
Well, I'll say this. I was fortunate enough to have people I was working with in my life that understood that when I came to them with the sober decision I made.
Right.
I was not asking their permission. Mind you, when I tell my agent at the time, hey, I'm not going to do rom-coms anymore. And he goes, okay. And I go, whoa, what do you mean? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
He said, okay, like that quick.
Yeah,
goes,
yeah.
Okay, I work for you. I don't work for them. I said, hang on a second, Jim. I go, what are your bosses going to say when you go into the office on the Monday morning meeting and say, oh, news brief, McConaughey's not going to be doing rom-coms anymore.
Yeah.
He's been bringing us a good dime on the dollar for a while.
Oh, yeah.
They ain't going to say, okay. And he goes, yeah. But I don't work for them. I work for you. But he was right.
Damn.
He stuck to it. He was my blood family, my brothers and my mom. They thought I was out of my mind. They're like, why are you getting in your own way? What are you doing, little brother?
It's like How to Lose a Guy in 30 Days has already been written. And you're like, yeah.
You know, people they were don't lined understand. Up. My wife understood it though. She was like, I got it. I hear you.
Yeah. People don't understand. I try to explain to them like, how long you win a title. How long does that last? About a week, a month, or 2 days. I mean, you want that next challenge. I'm looking for. I'm not excited. I'm not ready and excited until I got the next fight in front of me. What's my next challenge? What am I doing next? Because I'm working for that. The title, I got it. Okay, good. That's done. I mean, everyone asks me. I got four belts in my house in my garage in my closet. I think they're stacked up in my closet somewhere. I don't even have them out.
Right.
It won't last to me. But I mean, it is what it is. I'm proud of it.
I get asked that about the winning Academy Award. was that like a ta-da, okay, I've done it? I was like, no, it was the pinnacle of my acting career. And it meant my peers were validating that, hey, I'd become an expert craftsman. And they said that performance we deemed the most excellent. But shit, man, I mean, what happened after that? I sure as hell didn't get more complacent. I was like, all right, that's a peak on the way.
Right.
You know, a lot of things got to go the right way. If to win an Academy Award, I got teachers and friends. The movie's got to be good. I could have given a great performance. If the movie's a piece of shit, I don't win Best Actor. There's a lot of great performances out there that people have never seen because it was in a shitty movie.
Right.
A lot of things had to come together, and the movie worked, and it was, we were the underdog and had some momentum with some other films I was doing. The other performances were good. So, I mean, a lot of things happened, but I didn't feel like, oh, now I've done it. I was like, okay, that's awesome. I'm very appreciative of this. But yeah, like you're saying, what's next, man? What else is going to make me sweat in my boots?
How much is an Academy Award a driving force for an actor, do you think? And at what stage do you think it starts to become less of a goal and more about the work? Because I think a lot of people, and I know for myself, when I first got out of acting school, it was like, I thought, okay, getting, like, the same way in stand-up, you know, I'm a comic. It's like getting that first special validates you. So getting an Academy Award validates you.
Sure.
You haven't yet experienced enough ups and downs and really gotten experience in the grind to understand that it's, you know, it's a long haul. So was that ever a, you know, at the top of the list for you where every role, movie was being driven by that?
Look, I can say this. I've been doing it long enough where I can read a script and I, you know, and look at it and go, boy, if we pull this off, if I can pull this off to the best of my ability in this role and this movie is done well, this could be something that could be have critical acclaim.
Yeah.
Now, there's other movies I look at and I go, I want to do this. No matter how good this is never going to be one of those critically acclaimed Academy Award winning films. You just kind of know by the genre, you know, by the script. You've got a good hunch. I was just chasing quality dramas for the past 12, 15 years. And I will say this, though, you brought up about the result. Did I want to win an Academy Award in my career? You're damn right.
Yeah.
Damn right. But when I quit thinking about a result, started thinking this way right when I came out of that sabbatical 2 years, when I said, fuck the bucks, I'm going for the experience. I'm not worried about the result. I'm putting my head down and doing everything I can by hook or by crook for this role. When I quit worrying about that and just dealt with the process, I got a fuck lot more results. They got more trophies when I wasn't thinking about, oh, what's at the end of this?
Right.
What will it be? And I think that's something, Chuck, I suppose that's, I suppose I'd like to hear on your end. Is that, how true is that for you and your process when you were fighting the best?
Oh yeah, when I was fighting the best, I wanted the next big challenge. I wanted to fight the best guys out there. I was trying to prove I was the best in the world, to no one else but myself. So I wanted to fight the best guys out there. I was always looking for. The one thing Dana says about me is I never had to ask Chuck to. I had to worry about Chuck to turn down a fight. I just had to worry about him wanting to fight someone I didn't want him to fight.
Right.
Was like Chuck was asking for guys that I didn't know if he was ready for. Like I kept I always asked for the bigger guy. I don't, that guy's all right, but can I fight him?
Right. There you go, man. It goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago. Who's our greatest competition has kind of got to be ourselves, uh-huh. Right?
100%.
I mean, we got to flick our own switch and go, yeah, I mean, even times where I've gotten, you know, attaboys or pat on the backs or trophy for something, and I'm going like, I didn't quite nail it. That didn't live up to my own standard, you know? But I mean, that seems to be the ticket with anybody's success in anything, is you've got to be competing against your own best ability, and only we know what that is.
Well, that's what I'm curious about.
One second. We're talking about what's next. I'm sorry. I've been holding this for a little bit. I watched some of your stuff on politics and how talking about Band-Aids and how people are not. So much of politics to me is just then people doing things that make it look like they're doing something, but they're not really trying to fix the problem. Are you still thinking about running, or are you still thinking about running for governor? Or do you think
I'm as I've said before, and I'm not. Dodging the question with a real answer. No. I'm looking at what my next chapter is. What's my next chapter in for me in life, man? Where am I going to be the most useful? To me, to my family, and to the most amount of people? I'd be foolish not to look at politics as that's an embassy where you can have that influence to help people out and be of great service. So I'm looking at that. But I may be more useful as a free agent. I may be more useful as a doggone evangelist preacher. I might be more useful with starting a Green Lights Institute. I don't know. I may be more useful just sticking to being as good of a father as I can be and let that be an example. You know what I mean? I'm measuring all these things out. I do know a couple non-negotiable things are going with me whatever I go into the future, and that's my wife and my kids.
And I think that's what makes you appealing to people is you have strong beliefs and strong feelings, like it, and you're not going to bend and weave with a party line or whatever.
Shit, man. Especially now, man. I'm looking to be more me in my next chapter, man. I've earned some currency to get to this point. I'm sure as hell not going to be for sale. I want a challenge. I understand compromise and I understand, negotiations and discussions and being convicted another way that maybe I don't feel, but I'm not going in to go be flimsy and be a rubber band at anything I'm looking to do.
How do you manage knowing that you're, just who you are affects so much? I know I definitely was a way more Carl's Jr. once you started dropping your sweet pipes onto those spots. But just knowing that when you do enter into a new venture, knowing the impact and the effect you have on many people's lives, is that ever a burden? Is it ever pressure? Like, even if you're on a set, knowing that, you talking to a key grip or an extra for a couple moments, knowing the impact on their lives for that day. And I, again, for being, in this business, not at your level, knowing even just right now is such a treat. Like, is that lost on you or are you always aware of that?
I think I wear it more now. I think I understand it more now.
Yeah.
Like, I understand that the same words I say, if said by someone else, may not be received by people in bold print. It's like one of the things I noticed after winning the Academy Award, I would say stuff and it would be a headline. And I would be like, I've said that about 15 times.
But now it's special.
It's in bold print. It's a headline. You know what I mean? And I've had to notice that because I'm very, I try to be as direct as I can with people. And sometimes I'm not as sensitive with understanding, hey, this is coming in with my words can come at people in an intimidating manner. And I don't mean it like that, but I have to realize, whoa, what I think may bruise me or what I think may just be kind of bruising may feel like a break to someone else. So I got to watch that, as well. But as far as being in a position to have my voice heard in the way that it can be, I mean, I'm pretty much, I like being in the position of, give me the ball.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like being in the position to put me in the so-called ring and press record and let's see what happens on the first take, because that's always the best one. And I'll, I stick my foot in my mouth anyway from time to time as well. But I'm, I'm also into like, hey, what can we do? Let's all just tell our own truth and deal with the consequences.
I feel like you've been Matthew McConaughey, like dialed into who you are from the get-go. And I'm sure people have probably told you that before. Like, just listening to you articulate and tell the stories that you told. First of all, you're looking at three mama's boys in the room right now. So Chuck and I were very connected to that. And three so-called mistake babies. So let's put our hands in. Fucking mistake babies on three.
Yeah.
Mistake
babies. Thank you for the accident.
Yeah. Do you think there's more, and I think we can all probably relate to this. Is there, when you hear that from your folks, like not being planned, is there an extra level of like, all right, well, I got more to prove now?
Oh, hell, I don't know.
Is that too good of a question?
I thought of it that way. in the same way, my middle brother, he's adopted. He's still a McConaughey.
Yeah.
Not blood McConaughey, but he's still a McConaughey, and he was never treated any different or loved any different from my parents than I was or my older brother was. I tell a funny story early on. My mom and dad would take my middle brother, Pat, offer him every year on his birthday, we'll take you to Dallas, where your birth parents are, if you'd like to go meet them.
Wow.
Every year, no. Until he got to be 19. And all of a sudden, they asked him on his birthday, you want to go meet your parents in Dallas? He says, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They drive him from Longview to Dallas, about 3.5 hours away, pull up to the curb in front of the house, set up the meeting, say, we'll stay outside, Pat, you go on inside. My brother goes inside to go meet his birth parents for the first time, shit. 19 years later. And he comes back in the car, he's back, he leaves the house, comes out of the house, is back in the car in like 3 minutes. And my parents are like, what happened? You didn't want to talk to everything, go okay? He goes, yeah, everything's fine. He goes, well, what happened? You didn't want to sit there and talk to him? He said, no, I just really wanted to look at my dad's hairline because I'm starting to lose my hair.
That's fucking amazing, dude.
I don't know if I ever felt like I needed to have something to prove.
Okay.
To prove. Because our family, you didn't have time to dwell on, oh, was I an accident? It was like, be glad you were an accident. Come on, let's get on with it. You're here. What are you going to do with it? We love you. We love you just as much. Jeez, right. I'm glad dad's stuff stuck, you know?
By the way, glad dad's stuff stuck is like, could be another, I mean, I don't know if that's a t-shirt or a campaign slogan for you, but holy shit, man.
Definitely a bumper sticker.
Yeah, bumper sticker for sure.
I like that one.
Yeah, glad dad's stuff stuck. I love you talking about self-motivating, right? And I know, I think, you know, classically, Dazed and Confused is when you felt like you got noticed. But I know for sure you were probably grinding prior to that and thinking there were other things that were maybe going to, you know, be the thing that started everything off. How do you then and now stay self-motivated? Because, again, it, like Chuck and I were talking pre-show, it's like I just feel like it comes so easy for you. But, you know, the more you have on your plate, family, work, extracurricular, it becomes tougher to balance all that. So how does Matthew McConaughey just keep that fire going from day to day?
I mean, I think I'm naturally very curious.
Yeah.
I do like to take risks. And, you know, as we were talking a little bit earlier, now the time in my life and our lives where maybe we have a lot more currency. I got family. I don't want to be foolish with those risks. I'm not going to be foolish with what I built to get to this point, but I still want to get a buzz.
Right.
I still want to get a buzz in life. I still want to go into something, lean into the unknowns, lean into those blind spots a little bit more. Because my life's set, you know, we get successful. I could stop, I could probably retire right now and just stick with it, schedule exactly what I know, and that could be okay. But I think I'd get a little bored. I'm becoming less afraid of failing than I used to be.
Cool.
And I try to make sure I keep gnawing at it, that I stay vital and that I got my teeth on it, you know, on whatever I'm doing. And I don't know. I love trying to pull shit off. Mm. I love trying to pull things off. Can I, you know, whether it's even, you know, I like to hustle in both senses of the word, you know? Here's the worst feeling for me. What if that will keep my ass up at night?
Oh, wow.
If I would rather, I mean, if I give 100% of myself and pull it off, then I can go look in the mirror and go, you're responsible for that, McConaughey. If I bust my ass on something and fail at it, I can then at least look in the mirror and go, don't know what else I could have done. What I hate is that feeling of not pulling something off and going, did you half-ass it? Did you really not go? Did you not prepare as much as you could have? Did you not get it? Were you not present enough? Did you, you know, what? I don't like that feeling of wondering, what if I would have? Would I have been able to pull it off if I would have committed fully? You know, I don't. That's the feeling that'll keep me up at night. That's where I'll get a rest.
Great at putting things in words. I mean, I feel that same way. Like, you have for me for a fight. I always told you, everyone said I was known for not getting nervous before fights. It was because I did everything I had to do to get to that fight.
Right.
To get ready for that fight. So win, lose, or draw, I was fine. As long as I did my best, went out there and gave it my all. Whatever happened, happened. That's what happened that night. But the worst feeling in the world is to have a bad outcome on a fight. And I look back and go, man, what if I hadn't done that? What if I hadn't? And that'll eat you alive.
Eat you alive, man. It's a horrible feeling. And you got to live with it for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
100%. Yes.
Were you, even when you were auditioning early on, did you have a fearless mentality? Because I know that's an easier said than done thing to, it's an acquired skill set, right? To get to a point to where you're like, I got to just, you know,
auditioning, get to auditioning sucks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's ask the actor real quick. What was I asking you for? Hold on a second, Matt. Chuck, when you auditioned for Entourage, now what was that?
Well, that one I didn't have to audition for. Oh, thank God, they just gave it to you.
Okay. Yeah. But no, like, are you, you know, even when you started off, did you have a, let's just go for it, leave all parts of me in the room and see what happens?
I tried.
Yeah.
And look, I made a fool of myself and didn't get a lot of jobs where I went for it and completely whiffed. You know what I mean? I've had many auditions that I didn't get that I went for it. And that when they walked out of there and the cast director and directors were like going,
who the fuck was that?
All I know is that is not what we're looking for.
There's no way that guy's selling cars in 30 years. Yeah.
And mind you, I could drive home after not getting that gig and be like, well, you missed that one, but man, you swung. I had another, I U-turned, on a highway in LA after an audition that I went in and I thought I could get the part and I got nervous right before and I tried something and I saw a few times to take a risk and I didn't. And I left going, you didn't find out. And I remember I U-turned, went back, barged in, knocked down the door, went back in there, and it was the role of the baddie. So I went up and then I cornered, got the director and slammed him up in the corner and just played the role much better than my audition.
Holy shit.
And told the casting director she needed to do this, that, and the other, and da, da. Anyway, and then just barged out of there, knocked over furniture. And I was like, tell myself, I was like, that's the role. Now, when I left,
they called security.
Next thing I know, my agent calls. She goes, they're calling saying that you're disturbed and that was a problem and you need help. And I was like, oh no. And they're like, you definitely didn't get the part.
Not even a callback?
Yeah. No, not even close. Not even close.
To be honest,
then at least I knew.
But when you're doing that kind of part, it's so hard to do when you're sitting there looking at a piece of paper. Because I went in to go audition for a part, and they said I already had the role, but out of respect for the person that picked the people, they wanted me to go audition, and I had to do the audition. I'm sitting there trying to like threaten someone while I'm looking at a piece of paper. I'm like, I really can. You want me to punk somebody? It's in my nature. I'm good. I can do that if you need me to. I mean, that's not my nature, but I'm good at acting that part out because people ask me to do it to people all the time, so. I'm like,
By the way, this is why life rules. If somebody told me today, hey, today you're going to listen to Matthew McConaughey and Chuck Liddell swap audition stories, I would have been like, get the fuck out of here, Dad.
Yes. Here we go.
This rules. All right. So first of all, tackling a book, is it, you know, by the way, are we looking at a 30 plus year career? When do you truly feel like it started and how long you've been in the thick of it? Or do you even think in terms like that?
Career wise?
Yeah.
Well, and I remember 1992, man, summer of 92, Austin, Texas. I'm between my junior and senior year. I go to the right bar at the right time. Bartender, I go to that bar because that bartender gives me free drinks. He brings me over my vodka and tonic, says there's a guy at the end of the bar that's been coming in each night. He's in town producing a film. Takes me down, introduces me to him. The guy's name is Don Phillips. 4.5 hours later, Don Phillips and I, after many vodka tonics, get kicked out of the bar.
Yes.
Riding home. He's in the cab. He's going to drop me off at my apartment. 2:30 in the morning. He says, McConaughey, you ever done any acting? And I said, man, I was in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long. I wouldn't call it acting, more of a modeling job. Like, I write for this part. In this movie we're doing, this guy named Wooderson. He kind of hangs around the high school, likes the high school girls. Come down to this address, pick up the script at 9:30, which was about 6 hours later. I go down there, pick up the script. There's a handwritten note from him, 3 pages, 3 scenes. I read for it. I get the role. I go down to the set. End up working 3 weeks. All right. Now, that 3 weeks, I'm getting paid $320 a day. I'm getting invited back to set. I'm getting thrown in scenes. I'm improvising. I'm riffing. The rest of the cast is lobbing me lines, writing me into the movie. I'm going, this is fucking fun. And the people are telling me I'm good at it. And I'm going, $320 a day. I've been making about $75 a night tips. is this legal? So I finish that, go back to school, graduate, drive out to Hollywood, $2,000 a U-Haul, and was going to go for the acting gig.
Yeah.
First two auditions I had in Hollywood, I got the damn job.
Holy shit. That's unheard of, so by the way.
What's that?
That's unheard of, by the way. I mean,
angels in the outfield and boys on the side. First two auditions I ever had in Hollywood, and I got the damn job. So then I'm going, okay, I got a little momentum. I'm getting some work. Then A Time to Kill happens. I become famous, become movie star. So now I'm getting studio pictures coming my way. Now I'm like, okay, I'm making a career of this. But I still never studied acting in my life. Then I get turned on to a lady by that man, Don Phillips. Don Phillips, yeah. 1998, tells me you got it. He says, Matthew, it's time to lower your handicap, your acting handicap. I go, what do you mean? He goes, you got to meet with this lady, Penny Allen. Her and I, she was my mentor and my teacher for 19 years. That's when I learned the craft of acting. That's when I learned my rights as an actor. That's when I learned how to break down a script, how to get out of trouble if I had too much tension on a set, how to be free, how to prepare. And that's when I really became to understand the craft and was like, okay, not only do I have a natural instinct for what I'm doing and what's becoming a career, I actually now understand what the hell I'm doing and how to do it. And that was a wobbly transition for me because, I'm sure you know this, Chuck, you got a natural ability to do something and you've never studied it. And now all of a sudden you say, now I'm going to study it. Well, shit, now you're getting heady for what was always just an instinct.
Sure.
And it's wobbly because you lose your instinct a little bit while you're trying to process all the shit through your mind. But if you stick with it, I was then able to go, oh, now everything I'm learning is instinctual. And it turned into, it's been over 32 years, I think, whatever, 19 or 29 years. It turned into a career that I love. But I probably didn't notice that until that it really was a career. Well, before A Time to Kill, probably 1994, a couple of years after Dazed, after I'd gotten a few gigs, I was like, I think I understand this, and I think I'm decent at it.
You talk about how it took you a few beats to get the craft down, but I don't know, man, the way you acted being lifted by two angels into the outfield to catch that ball was pretty stellar, dude.
See that, man? Ben Williams, he's in right field. How's he going to get it? And the wires, the harness is on me, man, and through the wall, he caught it. He's out.
Dude, I've been trying to pitch Tony Danza in Angela's in the outfield. So if you know anybody, dude, but even a movie like that, like I'm sure your approach was like, okay, cool, man. Like I'm in a film. I got a role. This is my job. This is who I am to this film. Taking it with the same seriousness that you did.
I took that. I remember there's a scene that I'd worked on. I had one kind of real scene. I think it was with Danny Glover where it was like I tell him where I'm from and why I love baseball and everything. I rewrote that whole scene. I made it about eight times longer than it was.
Of course.
And I was like, even at that age, I was like, I'm not going to tell the director. I've added and rewritten the scene. I'm just going to do it.
Ballsy.
And I did it. And he come back and he's like, okay, that's all great. But the scene's now about 8 minutes long. And we need the scene to be, the scene's really half a page. Can you get back to about 30 seconds? I was like, nope. Go again. And I did it again my way. And I remember Danny Glover, after about take nine, and the director's William Deere going, Matthew, this is great stuff, but the movie's not about your character. Where it's from. I go, for me, it is right now. And I remember looking over after take 15, Danny Glover was sitting over on his chair, his head back. and it was late at night, and here's this young new guy in here going around and sticking to his guns, and the director's going, I appreciate what you're doing, and it's good, but I go, well, you do, that's what I can give you. You do what you did, and so they just cut it way down and made the scene work. But I was, trying to do that from the beginning, and always taking, even with the romantic comedies, I would work just as hard as I do on damn Dallas Buyers Club to try and make them work for me, but. Yeah.
Do you think there's DVD extras of that monologue anywhere on the cutting room floor?
He's got them. I guarantee you. Man, there's a bunch of unseen extras of me going with long, long extra riffs and scenes. Every time I approach a scene, I'm like, well, what would you say if this conversation went on for an hour? What would my character do and say if there wasn't an end to the scene? Just as an exercise to know where I'm going and So in the same way, I go, what would I say if the scene was on? What was I doing before I came to the scene? What would I say for an hour? What would be the dialogue that I would have leading up to this scene? Just to give a heads and a tails, an entrance and an exit.
Yeah, I didn't realize you like to improvise and play as much as you're telling us. Like, you know, in stand-up for a comic, I write a lot on stage. I take nuggets of ideas. I like to play with it. That's a, you know, and even in acting jobs, it's like, especially if it's comedy-driven, that helps me find and flesh out the character more if there's always options to play. Is that something that you have to really get on the same page with the director about, or do you go in full McConaughey, Angels in the Outfield, like, I'm doing it because I need to do it?
Well, I've learned to go, it has to be within the context
right.
of the scene in the movie. And I think I've kind of honed a bit of an art to go, okay, here's riffs and improvisations and things I've written that are true to the scene. And it may be too much. A lot of times I do it and I just, we throw it all away. It's not like it has to be in the movie. Cut it all. I just need to do that to get caught up. Like you're saying, Chuck, it's hard to read off a page, but if you're sitting there talking and you and I are jiving, and then you get to that line and now we've talked for 10 minutes and now it's time for that line, you're going to be much more comfortable if we're in the midst of going back and forth in a conversation of hitting that line. It's hard to do it from a fresh start, fresh stop. It's like one of the hardest lines in the world for an actor to do is just you cut to the actor and they go, yes. One word's tough. It's a lot easier to go, well, I mean, you sure you don't want to do the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially the newer.
It's a lot easier to get warm up, but that becomes a lot of lagniappe too. Right. You can have a lot of extra fat on that meat, stuff you don't need, but you need to get you up in a pace and get you a rhythm to get in so you can be present in the scene that you're in. I'll write stuff and I'll run stuff by directors.
Cool.
Or a lot of times I'll just do it. The thing on Wolf of Wall Street, I'd written that up. That scene was a lot shorter than it ended up being. I just showed up and just did it. And Martin Scorsese just laughed his ass off. And I said, is all that cool? And he was like,
yeah. Oh, man. Double thumbs up from Scorsese.
You know? And so he wasn't listening like, wait a minute, why is he saying this stuff that's not in the script? He was just listening going, this is that character.
Yes.
Well, okay. That's the difference of you being doing it, because when I do that, like if I start just throwing words in, they're like, can you just read the script?
Yeah, just stick to the script, tough guy. Yeah.
Just read what I said.
Yeah. Chuck, the character has nothing in here about owning a Quiznos franchise. Just stick to the dialogue, dude. Yeah. But I thought it was funny. Yeah. Hey guys, Adam Ray here for the About Last Night podcast. And I'm sitting down because I got some big news. Usually I'm standing up to do comedy, but I'm sitting down now because I got the deal of a lifetime. First of all, sitting is bad for you. We all know that, whether we're sitting on planes or sitting on a beanbag chair watching porn in front of our kids. There's just too much damage you do on the body. Thankfully, Axion has come up with a chair that allows your pelvis to move the way it does while you walk. So all 33 vertebrae align into perfect posture. The result? Better breathing, better blood flow, and relief from the pain. It's crazy what you can do when you set your body to do it. Now, these guys are homies of mine. My buddy Dennis worked with the Clippers as their doctor for 27 years. He runs a wellness center called Peak Wellness. He's a fucking gangster and has saved me from surgery numerous times. I actually met Justin Bieber at his place. And I was in my boxers getting cupping done, and Bieber and I locked eyes, and I was like, this is how we were supposed to meet. And Bieber smiled, and I never saw him again. This chair is a game changer. It's changed the way I live. It's changed the way I breathe, the way I sit. And you guys right now can get that chair for 25% off using the promo code ALN25 at all33.com. Go to all33.com and use promo code ALN25 for 25% off this chair. It's incredible. You got to get it. It's the only chair out there to get. We will be getting them for the studio, but don't take my word for it. Check out this video.
At All33, we've always pushed to reimagine the way we work. That's why we designed our revolutionary sit-in-motion technology to help people perform and feel their best. Then all of a sudden, the whole world was free to rethink how we work, and especially where we work. And as Americans came home, so did we. we approached the design of our chairs with a person and planet first mindset. That's why we chose to build them here in the United States. Manufacturing in the U.S. means we're able to have eyes on every step of the process, from material sourcing to part production to testing, even shipping, and we're able to recycle materials, use less energy, and reduce our carbon footprint. We've built the healthiest chairs you will ever sit in to keep you and the world moving, because movement makes things happen.
Wait, so Scorsese, I mean, Zemeckis, Spielberg, Ron Howard, like, do you get to a certain level where you and these directors, I mean, how much of pre-shoot talk is going on to even, like you said, you didn't even tell Marty you just were going to do that and trusted that you had done your work to serve the moment, right? You knew this wasn't going to be extraneous.
And hoped it would fly. Yeah. I mean, the challenge with doing that is, when you're giving somebody new information that may not be written, you better pull it off the first time, because 100%. They're already going, what the fuck's he doing? This is not in the script. Yeah. So there are ears already going, like, not wanting it to work because it's not there. But if you pull it off and it sings the first time and they're a good director and that what you did was right on and true for your character, they're like, yeah. And I mean, you just got to pull it off. Look, Ron Howard said this to me. That in Ed TV.
Yeah, classic.
The writers had a very different meter. Lowell and Babalu, they had a very different meter for comedy than I did. And so I kept going to Ron. I was like, can I change these words? And I kept going back to him. And finally he goes, Matthew, I don't care what you say, but you have to get me from point A to point B in this scene. So just do it. And it has to be in a certain amount of time so we don't have a 9-hour movie. But I don't care how you say the joke. You know, and so a lot of times I'll write something 10 times longer and go and leave the original script. And where do I end up? Right back at the original script. Because I had to go off, test it, know everything that's around it, different versions, and it ends right back to the original script. And you go, oh, now I understand the original words that were written. So it's not always about just doing something different or more. It's just an exploration of understanding what's there on the page in the first place sometimes.
One of my favorite lines, and Chuck, I know we were talking about this too, was earning your Saturdays and how we all need discipline. I mean, shit, dude. In all of our businesses, I think that could not be more true. Is there a specific routine now you have where you are still, like, how are you earning your Saturdays now? And does it get tougher to kind of maintain that philosophy as you get older?
I don't know. I mean, again,
we can move on. That was a bad question. I'm sorry.
I have stuff to do. You know what I mean? I mean, I Monday through Friday, I'm a pirate with the knife between my teeth grinding. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then Friday afternoon, I can drop the knife and go, whew, all right. Looks good in the rearview mirror. I accomplished what I did. Here's what I didn't get done. Here's what I could do better. All right, let's relax. It's Friday, Saturday night, and whatever that is. Yeah. At the same time, as a creative and a writer and stuff, a lot of my best ideas come at 2 a.m. on Saturday night when
too.
I don't have the knife between my teeth grinding.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? A lot of it comes from music when I'm relaxed and not just like go get it done. I've got plenty of things on my proverbial desk that I've got to tend to that I've built to this point that I'm still trying to build that keep me busy. And like I said, does that cocktail taste better at 7 p.m. after a good... on Tuesday evening after a Tuesday where you got in and grinded. That Saturday feels better. Sleeping in that extra couple hours feels more earned if you put in the damn good week. But boy, you give it, you know, you don't have the week. You don't have the work to do. You give a man too many Saturdays. Woo! We can become a tyrant now. I mean, it's like, you know, another thing with a man, somebody with nothing to do, usually the next move, if someone's up to nothing, usually their next move is being up to no good. And I mean, too much, again, those boundaries, too many Saturdays in a row. It's like, well, shit, man. I'm tired of eating cake. My teeth are falling out.
Well, yeah. I mean, for being a driven person, I know people.
It's like, this last couple of years, I've been like, I like how the calendar's set up. 5 days and a 2 day weekend. Yeah. 1 month and then 12 of those for a year. I like how it's set up.
What is that cocktail, by the way? That cocktail of choice when you do, when you've earned it? Is there a
cocktail
go-to?
Of choice is usually a Long Branch bourbon or a little Clase Azul tequila.
My man. On the rocks or neat?
I go a couple of rocks, slightly chill.
Dude, that's awesome. Yeah, and for me, that's the same thing. You're a driven person. You have to have something going on. You have to have done something, because otherwise you feel like, oh man, I'm taking night weed off, but well, I got this other stuff I didn't get done. I didn't do that. I didn't get this. Like I said,
it adds up, man. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, if I put in a good week, I can enjoy whatever I'm enjoying Friday night and wake up Saturday morning and less of a proverbial hangover than if I had a half-ass week that same Friday night. I got more of a hangover that Saturday just because I don't feel like I earned it. You know, not because of the amount I had to drink or intake, but actually, did I earn it? You know what I mean? I got plenty to keep me busy. The last thing I want on my plate is the idea of retirement. I'll find something to do. I gotta be chasing down something or building something.
Do you, how often do you think about your fraternity days? You and I share that. Chuck got free passes to all the frat parties. I know, yes. For me personally speaking, I've got a plethora of jokes about my frat days. Some are more flattering than others to the guys that are still around. But I definitely have pulled experiences and people that I have whether mimicked in my act or even for, you know, some acting jobs where the guys have to, you know, be a certain way, and that frat guy is a way to mirror it. But how many people in your life, because I'm sure there's been billions that have crossed your paths, have you pulled from in certain roles, or is it a collection for a given part?
It's a collection.
Yeah.
Look, I write about this in the book. I lived 4 years in not this Airstream, but another one called the Canoe, going around America, staying trailer park to trailer park. Took all my meetings in Hollywood on the road. That was a front line. I had a front line, front row class to behavior of sort of outcasts and outlaws, which I enjoy playing on screen. You know, I've got different characters that. It's a collection. There's one character that is one person in my life that is sort of, I call him my good luck charm, who has had a lot to do with the role of Wooderson and had a lot to do with the role of Ron Woodruff in Dallas Buyers Club. Even had to do with in Ed TV, and that's my brother Pat. That brother I was telling you that's a while ago, the one I was talking about being adopted.
Yeah,
he's kind of my lucky charm, man. And he's got a. He's informed quite a few of my characters in particular. But I keep diaries on people I've met along the way. And that's where I get a lot of my dialogue for certain characters too, is I'll throw something in for somebody I met in my travels, or remember the behavior of somebody on my travels, and sort of that'll inform what I do when I'm taking on the role.
That's how Green Lights came together, right? It was diaries on diaries over the past
37 years of journaling.
Man, somebody tell you to journal? Was it an instinctual, I need to start writing this cool shit down?
Well, at the beginning, it wasn't really cool shit. At the beginning, it was, you know, teenage crap. You know, why did Gretchen break up with me? Yeah, why do I got all these zits on my face? Kind of, you know, that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Why was one ball bigger than the other? Yeah.
You know, why does, you know, why do I only have peach fuzz?
Yeah, Craig's got full pubes. He's only a year younger than me.
So it was that original pubescent adolescent fun stuff, right, to begin with. But then... I kept writing because I started to notice in ways that maybe I was different. Meaning, I'm in a theater, full theater, and I'm laugh my ass off out loud at a joke, and nobody else laughs. But then the joke that the whole theater laughs at, I'm like, that's not very funny. So I started to write that down. Well, are you odd here, McConaughey? And then I started to notice, hey, dang it, I don't really cry at death, but I cry at birth. Why did I cry when that guy got let out of jail because they found out he was innocent? and he got his freedom back. And I'm weeping about that. But I didn't cry at the death of something. So I'm going, is this odd? So I just started to say, well, write it down. Keep a log of it. And then got the confidence to say, well, that's just how I feel about things. So go with it. And then it became, you know, when do most people go to their diary or the journal? When they were lost, confused, and frustrated. What I tried to remind myself early on was, hey, better put the pen to paper when you're flowing and succeeding and feel like you are dialed in. Yeah. Dissect the success instead of just dissecting the failures. And so what that helped me with is in life when I would have it, when I'd be rolling and I was on my frequency, I was jotting down my habit. So when I got off frequency and I got in a freaking rut again and was lost and going, what the hell's going on? I went back to those journals and like, well, what were you doing when you were rolling? And I would find habits, places I was going, people I was hanging out with, how much sleep I was getting, even what I was eating, that I'd go, oh, you quit doing that. Let's get back on track and try that again. And a lot of times it helped me get back on track.
Wow, dude. I mean, that is
great advice. I mean, I've thought about it so many times, and I just now wish, I mean, I've forgotten more stories than, you know, than I remember from growing up in the past. And so, yeah, that would have been great. Having that was amazing.
Yeah, to have you.
Well, think about it. When we're rolling, when you're training, when you're dominating it on the stage in a comedy act, when it's working, we think, well, this is it.
Yeah.
I'll never forget this.
Yes.
Because look at it. It works so well. It's just true. But the thing is, bullshit. We will forget it. Just write it down or record it, because
I'll record all my sets. Yeah.
That were like, this is perfect. I'll never forget this because it works so well for me.
Yes.
Yeah, we will. Or we go, oh, I'll never be in a rut again because I've got it figured out now. Yes, we will be in a rut again. And just go back and go, so we can go back. What was I doing when I was just nailing it? And you go back and you check it out and you go, oh, I see. I quit doing that. Or I took that for granted, or I got complacent here, blah, blah, blah. You know?
Learning from mistakes is such a, I mean, seems like such a basic thing in life, but it truly is. I mean, such a huge part of it that you don't, I think we all don't acknowledge enough as far as like the trial and error, like you just said, and to be able to hone in on what that is. And especially in your case, if you have it documented like that, it feels like you can't.
Learning from success, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
learning from your successes too. It's very, yeah. There. You can learn from both. Like now that you say it, like I used to watch when I win fights, when I lose fights, I'd find something to learn every time I fought, win or lose, what was great, what went on right, what went wrong. That's how you make your evolve as a fighter.
Right. And you would see stuff that you did that, oh, that was good. That led to my success. Or, I see what you did. I see why you got caught right there, because you didn't blah, blah, blah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, you know, sometimes it's a pause on a joke that I maybe need to adjust. And I find that out from learning on a recorded set from the night before. Or maybe the shirt was too tight. My nipples were too hard. And maybe, you know, I need to just, you know, wear a hoodie next time.
The crowd couldn't keep their attention on what you were saying because they were looking at your physique.
Yeah.
Never been the case, but thank you. We definitely, you know, I've talked so much and, you know, you're so generous with your responses. Have you gotten a question from a fan or an experience since the book came out that really kind of hit home? You know, like obviously, again, your impact on so many people's lives that you probably haven't even met is astronomical, but have you, you know, during this quarantine and pandemic, obviously there's more time to strengthen relationships, connect with people. Did you kind of do that on the fan front as far as receiving all the accolades and the ways people were connecting to what you put out?
Here's what I got. I've talked to hundreds of people, maybe thousands.
Yeah.
Over the last 32 weeks about green lights. Talking about similar subjects, I'm getting the same question off over and over and over, but it's original each time because each person has their own different context of how they understood that or in their own life. And the coolest thing that I heard was this. Oh, I'm seeing my stories in your stories, Matthew. Oh, I'm seeing myself in you, Matthew. Now, man, that's what I call art, when there's a reciprocity communication where we're seeing each other. It's something, my experience, you can see yourself in my experience. And then I hear about your experience, and now I can see myself in your experience. Now, here we go. That's cool. So that means it translated. That means that somehow my personal stories and approach and look at life hit a nerve with the common denominator of humankind in a lot of ways. Whether it's age, whether in different countries, no matter the sex, no matter the age. And that's, to me, makes me extremely gratified.
Do you, how often are you preaching to your kids some of the stuff from the book? Like, one thing I loved was you said you were taught to never hate, never say I can't, and never lie, which again feels very like sound basic knowledge, but so hard to implement as a human being.
Hell
in
yeah,
life. I mean, my senior yearbook quote was, there's three words I hate: can't, couldn't, and Vanilla Ice. Now, that was probably premature. Vanilla Ice is a talented fella. I was a big fan of his. There was probably another name to throw in there comedically. But, I mean, I'm the same way, man, where, you know, can't is just such a cock block of a word.
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that you're it doesn't mean that you're able to do something that you're not. Like, I physically do not have the ability to dunk a basketball, right? But if I would, like, my dad, the way my dad taught me, if I just said, Dad, I can't dunk, his molars would have met and he just started grinding them. And then he would have taken me out in the backyard, hoisted me up, and I dunked it, and he'd have dropped me, and he looked me in the eyes and he said, see, you are having trouble dunking. I mean, so
Whoa. It's
also about, I mean, he taught me that lesson when he had already told us about don't say can't, right? Mm. And I remember one Saturday morning, I got up 7 a.m. to do my chores, go and mow the lawn, weed eat everything, try to get them done by noon so I could go play. Lawnmower wouldn't start. I go in there, I go, Dad, I can't get the lawnmower started. Those molars met. I was like, oh, shit, I said that word. He got off his bed quietly, came out through the kitchen, the garage, around the back of the shed, went to the lawnmower, tried to crank it, wouldn't start, got down, found the fuel hose, hooked it up, got the fuel coming. Next thing you know, he cranked it. And with the lawnmower running 8 feet away, brrr, he came over in front of me, put his hands on my shoulders, knelt down on his knees, and he goes, you see, son, you were just having trouble. And I just went, got it. So it also means you can go get assistance. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes you can get help from others and you can pull something off.
It's okay to ask for help, right?
What's that?
It's okay to ask for help.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what is it? Don't lie. Oh, that's a great story in the book. I stolen a pizza with my buddy, Bud, one night. And we had planned to do it. And I got home at midnight, curfew. And my dad was on the phone with my buddy that I stole the pizza with his dad.
Hilarious.
And then he goes, yeah, he just walked in. I'll check it with him. He hangs up the phone and he goes, what'd you do tonight? So me and Bud went out and so-and-so and went to pizza. And then he goes, did you pay for that pizza?
Oh.
Now, any kiddos out there listening, if you stole a pizza or whatever it is, and you get home and your dad asks you, did you steal the pizza? It means he knows you did not pay for the pizza.
Yeah, yeah.
All right? But yeah. Me, I weaseled. I went, I think so, Dad. I'm going to ask you again. He gave me four chances to tell him the truth.
Oh, if you doubled down.
Well, I was digging a hole, and yeah. I knew I was starting to break a sweat, man. My old lactic acid legs were starting to wobble, but I was in deep, and I was just going to ride it out the back end like a weasel, right?
Yeah.
On the fourth time, he said, I'm going to ask you one final time, son. Did you steal that pizza? I said, well, I think he backhanded me. I crumpled up in the corner floor, not because of the strike of his blow, but because of those lactic acid bullshit coward ass legs I was standing that couldn't tell my dad the truth. And the back end didn't hurt. You know what hurt? Seeing his mouth fall open and being like, feeling like a failed father that his son couldn't tell him the damn truth about stealing a damn pizza. And if I'd have told him I'd have stole that pizza, he'd have been like, gosh, doggy, buddy. Number one, aren't you making enough allowance to pay for the pizza?
Sure.
Number two, if you're going to steal a pizza, you got to learn to get away with it better.
He would have made it a moment, right?
It would have, and he'd have hugged me and we'd have had a beer.
Yeah. Fuck.
And, but I couldn't do it. I weaseled out at that time. And then the other one was hate. I told my brother I hated him at my 8-year-old birthday party.
That's powerful.
Because I'd heard that word at school. My mom stops the birthday party.
Yep.
In front of all my friends. I had to lean against the wall and she gave me the belt against the wall. She goes, you do not hate. Now, what's the values in those things that I'm trying to teach my kids in different ways, but what I'm trying to teach them? What's the antonym, the opposite of those words? Well, as a kid, I noticed that I felt pain when I lied. So what's the opposite of pain? Pleasure. And as a kid, I noticed I felt pain when I said I can't. So what's the opposite of that? Well, you can be having trouble. What's the opposite of hate? Love. So love, you can be having trouble doing something and tell the truth. That's things I'm trying to instill in my kids along the way, just in different ways than my parents did. But that's what I'm still trying to instill in them.
Damn, dude. Do you have a few more minutes with us?
Let's roll.
Yeah, okay. My mom, again, Mama's Boy Club, MB. Mistake, baby, Mama's Boy. Maybe we should get those shirts, MB. My mom, Puddin' Cox, wanted to know, how did playing in Dallas Buyers Club change you? And how was that role a turning point in your career? It's her favorite movie.
How did it change me? Well, I mean, it was the role that I won the Oscar for.
Right.
So as we talked about that validity that for the first time, my peers deemed my work the most excellent in a male lead that year. That meant a lot to me. Again, that time in my career, I was not chasing results. Mm. I was like, I remember finishing the role the last night of shooting on Dallas Buyers Club, and they went, okay, cut, that's a wrap. It was on a Friday. I would like come up and go, okay, everyone, I'll see you Monday. Thinking that, and then they were like, no, that's a film wrap. We're done. There's no more shooting. I'm like, oh, my head was so down. It's like, I don't know, Chuck, do you have any fights where if you're coming out of round three or the round five, the final round, where if your mindset is that, oh, I've got six, seven, I can go three more rounds, that you'll do better in those rounds that you're in, if you're not thinking like, I just got to make it this one last round. If you're like the finish line, if you project in your mind, you do that trick like it's actually further than you think. I find that I do better work in the present.
Oh yeah, for sure. If I always need to be ready to go all the way to the end and be. I'm looking forward. I'm still working. I always feel like if you give me another round, I'll win. I'm gonna win this. Give me another round. So I was always pushing for that. I always want, always want to go after it.
Yeah, it was one of the great roles, and I was attached to that script for a long time before we ever got it made. No one wanted to make it with Matthew McConaughey in the lead. Many a director passed on that because I was attached for the lead.
That's amazing.
But I held on to it. Many actors wanted to take it from me, and me and my agent, I was like, no, this is on lockdown. One day, this script's going to see the light of day. And so when we got the chance to do it, and we didn't even have the money to make it, but we were telling Hollywood we were making it.
Wow.
We were saying we're shooting in October. And behind the scenes, my agent's going, you are not shooting in October. You don't have fucking money. We were like, yeah, we do. And he's like, you're delusional. Yeah. And we're like, so we just bluffed our way through and didn't flinch when the rest of the world said, you can't make it. We said, yeah, we are. And 8 days before shooting that, the director calls me and says, Matthew, I do not have the money to make this movie. I need $8 million, but they only have $4.9 million. But if you will be there on day one, I will be there. And I said, I'll be there. And we showed up, didn't have the money, cut the grip department, meaning no lights on the set, zero lights. Didn't have one light on that set because that was where we scrapped a lot of the money, didn't have the money to do it. And just went and shot it. Kind of forced it to be.
Holy shit, dude.
That's awesome.
I mean, just where there's a will, there's a way, truly, huh?
Oh, I mean, you're not going to get it made every single time, but shit, man. I mean, I've been a part of pulling some things off by not flinching sometimes when the stats or the science of the situation said, this is not possible.
Yeah.
If you just go, what do you mean it's not possible? It's happening. And all of a sudden, people were like, okay, I guess it's happening. And it was just momentum started rolling. We didn't have the damn money or nothing, but we were just going, yeah, we are.
Another question from some fans we got. How do you steer clear of scandal, Matthew McConaughey?
Scandal? How do I steer clear of scandal?
We live in a clickbait TMZ world. Even, I saw Chuck taking a shit a couple weeks ago. I took a picture and I was like, yo man, you mind if I sell this on eBay? And he was like, yeah, but let's negotiate a price. So like,
right. Let's split it.
Let's split it. Yeah. So it's a team player move, but how do you, for someone that's in the limelight, like how do you, other than just trying to live, I guess, a healthy life, right?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty. I'm not a real scandalous guy,
right?
And I'm pretty open and honest about where I fall down and step in shit, and I'll tell the joke on myself before someone else needs to tell a joke on myself.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I'll come out and go, "Yep, that was me," you know. Long before a lot of other people will. And the other thing is, you know, I mean, look, I write, and I got that line in the book. I got this hunch that the world's conspiring to make me happy.
Yes.
That's a trust. And some people think that this is something that I need to watch, but I think it's one of my better attributes or values is that I go into situations with high trust. I don't know you all, but I'm here sitting here talking to you. You have 100% of my trust until you don't. Instead of me coming in and going, you got zero of my trust and I'm watching out for you. Now, I've been playing this game long enough to know, by the way, what question you ask if you're trying to pick my pocket from the backside and get me to say something scandalous.
Right.
I understand that, and I understand how words can be pulled and high lit and put up. But at the same time, sometimes scandal is, you avoid scandal by not giving scandal credit. It's not a scandal. It was life. If I reply to it and start to add on to it, it can become scandalous. Mm. But if you sit there and go, no, that's just, and people get that that's just.
Oh, yeah. People take stuff. People take stuff out of context all the time, and I put something up. I think I did a thing for Jimmy Kimmel, like a skit where I jumped out of the back of the car for if you had a, road rage, right?
Yeah.
I was a road rage button. So I jumped out with jumped out of the back of a car with a tire on and beat this guy up, right? For the skit. It was just being funny, right? It was listed on some website, and I had friends actually call me up and ask me what happened. That just the headline was Chuck lost his mind.
About
with that tyrant. It was like, it said in the article that it said it was a skit and all that stuff. But my buddy never read the article. He just read the headline. Just said it. But oh, yeah. I always tell people, like, anything that I do or say, if someone takes it out of context, I can defend myself. I got a platform to do that anywhere. I can get people covered, and I don't say things that aren't cool. So I'm not an asshole. I don't treat people bad. I am me. So I'm not gonna, like, I say what you say about, I give people a lot of trust, and I've been screwed quite a few times on different things, but. You know, I don't want these people that screw me to win, because I think giving people I give you trust until you tell me I can't trust you. So right. That's I try, right. And I don't want them to win. So I think giving that up would be them winning. So
yeah, and the other tough part about it is that today a lot of people can just make something up, can just make up a lie about somebody, and so sometimes you want to straighten that lie out, but. I also question, geez, if you respond to a lie, you're already putting bullshit on top of bullshit.
Yes.
And it's feeding the lie, the original lie, where sometimes it's like, that's bullshit. I'm going to trust that the people that I care about can see through that. And you know what? We ain't going to please everybody all the time. It's that Sammy Davis Jr. line. Sammy Davis Jr. line. I don't know what success is, but I know what failure is, and that's trying to please everybody. They know a way to do it.
Wow.
There just ain't no way to do it. And...
just those people out there that do it just to be mean or whatever. I got people, buddies, I'm like, dude, why do you care what that guy says about you on the internet? Like,
yeah.
Do you know him? Does he know you? No? Neither of those? Then why do you care what he thinks?
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you read the YouTube comments or the Instagram comments or the reviews? Have you ever? Or was that just like, man, I'm going to do
it's
the
not
work?
A practice. It's not a practice. I tell you what I did do, though, about 15 years ago, I had my publicist get every negative review that's ever been written on any of my performances. And it was a thick, thick folder.
Is that the next book?
For a weekend and sat down with them and read every bad review that's ever been written.
Damn, dude.
But here's what I noticed, man, is that a lot of them, I could tell by the first sentence, that critic was writing a bad review on me before he even went to see the performance.
Yep.
He already had it in for me.
Yep.
They didn't like me. It didn't matter what. That bad critique was written before they even saw the performance. Then I also noticed many that wrote about me critiques saying they didn't like this. I was like, they got a point. That a constructive critique where someone's not just in to get you, but writes a bad review. I learned a lot about what I thought I was doing and what was coming off on the screen. you know, because there are a lot of times that what I intended to do, what I thought I was doing, was not actually how it was being received. And so I started to go, huh, how do I close that gap? So I went off and sat with all my bad reviews. And they, a lot of them were actually more well-written than some of the good reviews. Yeah.
How many bottles of Casa Azul were accompanying you on that?
I'll just tell you, they were empty afterwards.
Yeah. I want to read you one review from a mutual friend of ours, Sandy Bullock. I met her in 2013 doing the heat, and I hit her up and I was like, hey, do you got any good questions I should ask McConaughey? And she wrote me this and then asked me to share it with you. She said, there's not a fun story of MM that I can tell that he probably hasn't already told himself. And then she says, but truly the beauty of Matthew McConaughey is that he has been unwaveringly truthful about who he is. Transparent, unapologetic in his convictions, rooted in his faith and family, and is a reminder that we should seek out our joy in all moments in life, even the really shitty ones, because bidden or not bidden, God is present. And all is as it should be. He chose the most extraordinary woman as his partner, and it takes a secure and evolved man to allow a strong and evolved woman into his life and to be completely comfortable if her shadow should fall upon him. And he is. Because of her, his life is balanced and glorious.
Wow. Thank you, Sandy.
Come on, right?
I like that review. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, what about me? She goes, keep your shirt on. I was like, all right, fair enough. Yeah. Do you mind if we just do a quick 10 question rapid fire to close this out?
Yeah. Shoot it.
First of all, dude, thank you again. The book is incredible. I hope it's not your last. You have a way with words that, you know, makes Chuck and I feel very insecure about our, the way we talk and write, but inspiring too, which is like, you know, anything that's great like that, that as I'm listening, I'm like, dude, you have, I mean, in a weird way, even comedically, I was like, dude, it made me think more about just the way I'm using my words and structuring jokes, just the way that you effortlessly convey your thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you, man. I mean, it's, you know, it's musical, and you know, as a comedian, I mean, it's we're all telling stories.
Yeah.
And how do you get a good story told? You got to trust in the pregnant pause before the punchline, even though you're wanting to go, oh, it's silent, I can't trust. There's a timing to them.
Oh, you nailed those, dude. That was a very impressive, just from a comedic standpoint. I was like, man, this guy fucking, I mean, why have you not gotten on the stage? I know you've been on stages, but like, shit, man, maybe playing a comic in a you know, later film. I don't know. Has that ever interested you to even be on stage?
Just the whole idea of stand-up interests me. Just not even as a character, but to go do it. You know, this whole Green Lights tour before COVID came, I was going to hit the road.
Oh, shit.
And do a one-man show with Green Lights and tell some of these stories on stage and have that be the book tour. But then COVID came and I had to do it remotely. But that idea, talk about the most direct, you know, I go act. I'm doing someone else's script, directed by someone else, edited by someone else, and lensed into camera by someone else. That's four filters for my raw expression. Even a book is one filter. Mm. It's the written word. But boy, stand up, live, one take, that direct interaction, there's no freaking filter. I mean, boy, to pull that off, awesome.
Well, dude, when we all get back to LA and have our mama's boy party, you got to come out to a show, man. And throwing this out there, if the Green Lights tour gets back on the books, Chuck's got a killer five about Beanie Babies. I could open for him, then bring you out.
Ha, ha, ha. What is it? MBs.
MBs.
MBs. Show glad daddy stuffed up.
Dude, that's how we close out every show. Are you kidding me? All right. So you were obviously, an amazing guest on Inside the Actor Studio with the late, great James Lipton. Phenomenal episode. We like to close out every ep with that famous 10 question questionnaire. I know you answered on the show, but it's probably been a minute. So maybe your answers have changed and evolved, you know,
yeah.
But it's a fun way to get a quick insight into who somebody is. So Chuck, fire away with that first one.
Okay, what is your favorite word? Favorite word?
Unanimous.
What is your least favorite word?
Can't.
What turns you on?
Bo, By the way, let's just isolate that audio for a minute and send it to you in a direct link if you want. Chuck Liddell asking you what turns you on. That's a fucking, yeah, man. Yeah.
What turns me on? The fact that my daddy stuff stuck. something to look forward to turns me on.
I love
having
that.
Something to look forward to.
I love that. What turns you off?
Posers.
Nice.
What's your favorite curse word?
Fuck.
Are you more of a hard F guy? Or you kind of, you know, close it in with the CK?
Nah, I'm still, you know what I am? I'm still, you know, there's two kind of fucks. So there's the fuck you. And then there's fuck you.
Oh, damn, dude.
I'm a relaxed knuckle. Fuck you.
Yo, this is amazing. I just had this conversation with a comedian buddy of mine 2 nights ago about the old school straight up middle finger and then the guys that bent it down a little and don't want to give you the full fucking solo. There was a lot of power in biking on some guy's lawn and him just being like, hey, fuck you, kid. And you're like, dude, one solo finger? Yeah, dude.
It's old school, but it like really owns it, and it means you're not trying too hard. You're not having to flex your other knuckles.
Yeah, no knuckle flex, just a straight solo finger. A lot of damage is done. Yo, by the way, there's two kind of fuck yous by Matthew McConaughey. Next working title for your next book. All right.
Yes.
What sound or noise do you love?
Oh, my kids laughing, man.
Amazing.
I hear my kids laughing. I got it.
Are you guys goofing?
Got to go in the room and just peek in there.
Are you guys goofing a lot? Like what?
What?
Are you guys goofing a lot? Like, are you always just silly dad 24/7?
Not 24/7, but yeah, we like to go ahead and get goofy as we can. We try to have as much laughter around the house as possible.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the kids are getting pretty good. If they're the subject of who we're laughing at, it's on you. Of them feeling like, yeah, you know, I learned that trick. It's a trick. You know who's the best at that in the world of laughing at themselves when they screw up harder than you even laugh at them? Woody Harrelson.
No way.
Gosh damn, when he screws up, no one laughs at themselves harder.
Oh, that's amazing.
When they're the brunt of the joke than Woody. It's great.
That's amazing. That's so rare and infectious, right?
Yeah.
So then you can, absolutely. So what? Then you can pig pile on and just keep digging in and he just won't even be fazed by it?
I dig in and rib him about shit he did for the past 20 years. Yeah, 20 years ago, I've still got continuous ones. I'm like, you remember when you got here? He knows it's coming. And he's like, oh, yeah, I know. Oh, he's hell yeah. He's
that's into amazing, it. Dude.
What sound or noise do you hate?
What sound or noise do I hate? Man, the worst. What's the sound of the worst alarm clock on the planet? Yeah. You know what that is?
Which one?
Mosquitoes in your ear.
Oh. By the way, if the mosquitoes sounded like you, I don't think anyone would have a problem with them creeping up on your eardrums. Oh, fuck that. Yeah, man. You're making me want to cut this interview short.
When you're asleep and you do this, and you slap yourself in the head, but you miss the damn mosquito.
Yeah. And then And if anyone sees that, you're like, it was a mosquito. They're like, yeah, sure, man. You're fucking definitely not losing it. How about the noise of waking up on an airplane when you've been sleeping and you wake yourself up with the, yeah, nah, nah, nah. You ever done that? Am I the only one riding coach still?
You wake up and your jaw's locked up because you just had a nightmare and you wish you had a mouth guard in because you just, yeah, I've had a few of those. Yeah.
All right. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Orchestral conductor.
Damn, dude.
Okay. What profession would you not like to?
What profession would I not like to do? I would not like. No, I like that one. I like that one. I like that one.
Karaoke DJ?
No, I like DJing. DJing sounds great.
I know, right?
job would I not like to do? What do I not like?
Foot Locker night manager?
No, I could make that work.
Yeah.
I could make that. I could roll on that. I could DJ through that night easy.
All right, how about this? Mime porn fluffer.
What's the first word you said?
Mime. Mime porn.
Mime porn.
Don't know if it's a category. Just set it off the top. But guess what? There's something for everybody out there. You're fluffing the mime porn. $8 an hour.
You know what? I'll go a little more, sometimes whatever you got to get your minimum wage for, whatever raises your skirt, as my man Australian Steve says. I wouldn't want to be the job of, I don't want to be the, have the job of an atheist. Where'd that one come from?
Yeah, dude. Yeah, dude. Fucking mic drop McConaughey over here.
That's awesome.
Oh, shit. All right, last one. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Pretty good first round, McConaughey.
Dude.
That's awesome.
Unbelievable. Was a real fucking treat to meet you. The book is incredible. Yeah. For myself, selfishly speaking, dude, thank you for just being so committed to everything you've done over the past 32 years and giving us so much joy and laughter. I mean, shit, man. And you're not even done, man. I mean, it's incredible what you're doing. And thanks for, obviously, yeah. I know you did this because of Chuck Boy over here, so... Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on, and you really, really helped me with talking to people. Like a lot of things I try to get across. You say it so much better, and it really helps when I'm talking to them. I talk to a lot of military guys, a lot of retired athletes, a lot of people that are struggling. So it really helps. So thank you.